thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to The Esau Effect, Esau the Man. This teaching is brought to you by TheMessianicMessage.com, TheMessianicMessage.com. I hope you enjoy this teaching. I have good news for you. We live at a very unique time in history. How blessed we are to get to see the things that our biblical predecessors wanted to see, and how blessed are we that we get to understand the things that even Daniel didn't understand. God gives his people signs. Now, he doesn't give signs to the Pharisees, vipers, and hypocrites. But God is very good about keeping his people informed, isn't he? It's kind of like having to belong to the organization in order to get the newsletter. I pray to know exactly where we are in our prophesied journey. Well, I can tell you that God has not revealed to me exactly where we are. But in his mercy, he has given us a sign to let us know that biblical prophecy is right on track. Compare this end time journey to a road trip. You know, it can be irritating on a road trip with your family, especially with the kids constantly asking, "Are we there yet?" But every once in a while, it helps when mom or dad gives a positive sign that the family is moving right along and in the right direction. The children might not know exactly what time the destination will be reached, but seeing the signs along the way is encouraging, isn't it? In fact, I'll bet you rely on those road signs for your own serenity when you're driving. Those road signs really help us, don't they? Can you imagine traveling across country with no road signs? It would take almost no time at all, once we got outside our own territory, for us to get lost. And there are so many places that look like the place we want to be in, but they aren't. Those signs reassure us that we're on the right road, going to the right place. And as long as Dad shares that information with the kids, everyone is usually happy. That and a couple of pit stops, right? Well, Abba has given us a sign to help us know that his prophesied world events are still on track, and that he is still driving the car. This sign doesn't tell us when anything is going to happen. It doesn't specify any dates or anything like that. The sign merely tells us that we're on the right road. We're going to get to our destination. If you're like me, you're asking, "Are we there yet?" Well, we're not quite there yet, but we are on track. One of God's signs comes from the blessings of Jacob and Esau in Genesis 27. Before I show you the sign, we first have to take a journey, starting from the book of Obadiah, then to the beginning in Genesis, and then until we reach the end, right in front of the sign. Let's look at the book of Obadiah, chapter 1, verse 6. How are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? That's what this teaching is, learning to search out the secret things of Esau, learning to read the sign of Esau. Let's turn to chapter 27 in the book of Genesis. This is Jacob's blessing that he got from Isaac. It says in verse 28 and 29, "Therefore God give you of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth, and plenty of corn and wine, Let people serve you, and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brethren, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be every one that curses you, and blessed be he that blesses you. Now let's go down and read Esau's blessing that he got from Isaac. Verses 39 and 40. And Isaac his father answered and said to him, Behold, your dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above. And by your sword shall you live and shall serve your brother. And it shall come to pass, when you shall have the dominion, that you shall break his yoke from off your neck. We're going to find out what verse 40 means. We have been looking at Islam as the enemy, as if Islam is our greatest threat. Indeed, Islam is our enemy, but Islam is not the enemy because it is the weapon of the enemy. We need to find out who is wielding this weapon. Islam is not prophesied by name or direct implication in Scripture. Islam can only be ascertained through the inference of the connection of Ishmael to modern Muslim nations. There is an enemy hiding behind the weapon of Islam, using Islam as a cover that is more formidable than the Islamic threat, and that has exercised heavy influence over Islam. This enemy's end will be more dire than the end of any other people on earth, including the Muslims, many of whom will escape when the enemy behind the weapon of Islam is destroyed. The problem we face is in identifying this wielder of the weapon of Islam. Always remember, the enemy you cannot see is the most dangerous enemy of all. That's where this sign comes in. Who is this enemy? Where is he now? What kind of ideology powers him? What is behind his bloodthirst? And how can we learn to recognize him? The answer to who is this enemy is easy. His name is Esau. The rest is not so easy because Esau is hidden everywhere in the world. Ishmael is easy to find. He can be seen. But his powerful compatriot, Esau, is hard to find. In a little bit, we'll find out why Esau is so hard to find. We'll find out why Esau is hidden. And later on, we'll discover that he's been under our noses all this time, but we couldn't see him. And again, the most dangerous enemy is the one you can't see. The blessing Isaac gave to Esau is more like a curse than a blessing. For us, it is a blessing because it contains the sign. The blessing says a time is coming when Esau will gain dominion and break free of a problem, a yoke, that he's carried with him from the time that he received the blessing. Literally, this prophecy tells us that Esau will be a servant to Jacob. And, like a servant, he would necessarily be out of sight, out of mind, like most servants are. He literally will have what we call a low profile. At some point, though, he will have a high profile. And any time someone goes from having a low profile to having a high profile, he becomes more easily identifiable. Now it is possible to identify Esau in the earth. Notice in the blessing that Jacob gets the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth. But Esau gets to dwell there. Like a guy renting a house, it's not his. He can't do whatever he wants or needs to with it. Forever, Esau has to live with the fact that he will dwell where the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth are, but the rightful owner is someone else, Jacob. Esau has the right to access the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth, just like the renter has the right to access the water and use the kitchen, but someone else owns these. The blessings of Jacob and Esau have near and far fulfillments. Much of these blessings have not yet come to pass. For instance, Jacob is not yet served by all the other nations. Jacob will be Lord over his brethren, which is a clear reference to Yeshua the Messiah, who truly will reign over everyone on earth. But Yeshua is not yet reigning on earth. And Jacob, having plenty of corn and wine, living the plentiful life of ease, well, that has partly come to pass, especially when Jacob first entered the land of Israel. I'm sure that was just a foretaste, though, of a later fulfillment to come, specifically in the Messianic kingdom. And Esau will earn his living by the sword, plundering from wars or working as a mercenary. We're going to see that this is exactly what Esau has done. So, Esau gets second place, yet it is said that he will one day gain dominion, which means he will have first place. Further, reading Esau's blessing in order, it appears Esau will break the yoke of Jacob after he gets dominion. He will break the burden of Jacob from his neck after he gets the dominion. Keep this in mind. It implies that there is a particular time in history when Esau will rise to power. Now, let's turn our attention to the physical attributes of Esau. These two babies, Esau and Jacob, could not have been more different. Esau was a rough and rugged type. Genesis says he was hairy all over. Genesis 25:25. And the first came out all red, all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. Esau's hairiness is from the Hebrew word sear. He was like a hairy garment, ka'adret, in Hebrew. As hairy as an animal, the Bible says he also was rough, asa. This hairy baby was also ruddy or reddish. Now, the Bible does not specify whether both his skin and hair were ruddy, admoni in Hebrew, or whether just one or the other was ruddy. Isaac and Rebekah named this hairy, sear, rough, asa, reddish, admoni, baby, Esav, Esau. Esau was a physical man, a rough and tough character. He was a man of the field who enjoyed hunting and killing things more than life itself. Genesis 25:27. And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man, dwelling in tents. By contrast, Jacob was the gentle guy, the cook, the farmer, and today would possibly be a geek. Jacob was probably well versed in medicinal herbs and used them for the health of the flock he legally and ethically obtained from Laban. During that episode with Laban, Jacob peeled the bark of the limbs of the trees to expose the entire medicine within the limb to the water in the troughs. With this, he prevented water belly, calcium buildup in the urinary tracts, gynecological problems, and various inflammations. So Jacob was a careful, methodical man who loved learning, and he was an excellent shepherd. Esau cannot be a shepherd because he is a stalker, a killer, not a protector. He preferred to live the rugged life, like the life of those rough and tough characters of American history that we now call mountain men. The two job descriptions of Jacob and Esau are adverse to each other, and we will learn more about this later, because right now we're going to look at the history of the Edomites, and I think we're going to get some surprises. Let's jump all the way forward now to Genesis 36, and we're going to study the begats. Genesis 36, verse 8. Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. The quick and easy description of the location of Mount Seir that became Edom is an Iron Age kingdom of southern Jordan, or an ancient country of Palestine between the Dead Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba, whose ancient capital of Edom was Basra. Keep that in mind for later on. The region called Edom was inhabited by the Horites. They were among the tribes involved in the war that led to Lot's capture in Genesis 14, the war that led to Abraham rising up to go to war to get Lot back. How did Esau obtain the region of Mount Seir? He took it. You see, Esau was a warrior, but he was cunning. He was a stalker. A guy who goes around taking what he wants through war, stealth, and clandestine operations. We'll learn more about the word cunning in the next section. So Esau went to cunningly absorb the Horites and conquer them by war. Some people call that assimilation. I think that word is too nice for what Esau does. Let's have a look at the begats to see what the scriptures show us as a pattern. Genesis 36, starting with verse 1. Now, these are the generations of Esau, who is Edom. Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan, Adah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite, and Bashamath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebaioth, and Adah bare to Esau Eliphaz, and Bashamath bare Reuel, and Aholibamah bare Jeush and Jaalam and Korah, or Jeush and Jaalam and Korah. These are the sons of Esau, which were born to him in the land of Canaan. And Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all the persons of his house and his cattle and all his beasts and all his substance which he had got in the land of Canaan, and went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob. For their riches were more than that they might dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. So Esau moved his small family to Mount Seir. While Esau was in the Horites' Mount Seir area, he began to have generations. In other words, Esau's family grew and grew and grew. Starting in verse 9. And these are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in Mount Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Adah, the wife of Esau; Reuel, the son of Bashamath, the wife of Esau. And the sons of Eliphaz were Taman, Omar, Zepho, and Gatam and Kenaz. And Timnah was concubine to Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bare to Eliphaz Amalek. These were the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. And these are the sons of Reuel, Nahath and Zerah, Shema and Mizah. These were the sons of Bashemath, Esau's wife. And these were the sons of Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon, Esau's wife. And she bare to Esau Yeush and Ya'alam and Korah, or Jeush, Ja'alam, and Korah. This generational list is a hint on what is about to happen at Mount Seir. Remember, the Horites were no cowards. These were warriors. But I guarantee you, they didn't see Esau coming until it was too late. Let us not make the same mistake. Now, let's look at Deuteronomy 2, verse 22, where it talks about how God drove out the Horites for Esau, as he, God, did to the children of Esau, which dwelt in Seir when he destroyed the Horim from before them, and they, Esau, succeeded them, the Horites, and dwelt in their stead even to this day. Now, back to Genesis 36 and to verse 15. Notice in that verse where the language suddenly changes. These were dukes of the sons of Esau, the sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn son of Esau, Duke Taman, Duke Omar, Duke Zepho, Duke Kenaz, Duke Korah, Duke Gatam, and Duke Amalek. These are the dukes that came of Eliphaz in the land of Edom. These were the sons of Adah. And these are the sons of Reuel, Esau's son, Duke Nahath, Duke Zerah, Duke Shema, Duke Mizah. These are the dukes that came of Reuel in the land of Edom. These are the sons of Bashemath, Esau's wife. And these are the sons of Aholibamah, Esau's wife, Duke Yeush, Duke Ya'alam, Duke Korah. These were the dukes that came of Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Esau, who is Edom, and these are their dukes. Now, all of a sudden, it isn't about the sons or generations of Esau anymore. It's about his dukes. Let's take a closer look at the word duke. It is Strong's 441, aluf in Hebrew, and it means chieftain and governor. This form of governing, local chieftainship or local governorship, has been used from antiquity, from the time of the Roman Empire all the way to modern America. But before that, it was used by Esau. Esau set up localized government, dukes, at Mount Seir, within the Horite government. You see, there were still some Horites left, and apparently they were still in power as rulers at this point, because Esau's power was only that of dukes. We know this because after the mention of Esau's dukes, the Bible still speaks of the sons of Seir the Horite. So some Horites were still there. So besides driving out the Horites with God's help, Esau also dispossessed them until there were no Horites left. Let's look at verse 20 to see what I mean. These are the sons of Seir the Horite, who inhabited the land, Lotan and Shobal and Zibeon and Anah. The sons of Seir the Horite would have been in powerful positions. But notice what happens next. Verse 21. and Dishan and Azer and Dishan, these are the dukes of the Horites, the children of Seir in the land of Edom. And then skipping down to verse 29, these are the dukes that came of the Horites, Duke Lotan, Duke Shobal, Duke Zibeon, Duke Anah, Duke Dishan, Duke Azer, Duke Dishan. These are the dukes that came of Hori among their dukes in the land of Seir. Just as suddenly as Esau rose to power, the Horites lost power, because now they're reduced to dukes and not rulers. Did you see how that happened? Now, isn't that interesting? The Horite descendants took up the practice of having localized governments within the ranks of Esau. Esau moved in, he formed a localized government within the Horite culture, and before the Horites that were left knew what happened, they were following Esau's form of government and were reduced to localized powers only. Genesis 36, verse 31. Now let's see what happens. And these are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. Now at this point, the land is called Edom, not Mount Seir, and not the land of the Horites. And kings? Esau went from having mere localized governments within the large one to having kings to rule over the Horites. Here is what God wants us to see. Number one, God himself paves the way for Esau through war. This is all part of God's plan to justly destroy his enemies and bring the earth back under his control. And number two, cultural absorption is not the Islamic MO. It is the Edomite MO. They dwell in the places they want to take over. They always form their own government within the existing government. They encroach on the culture until the culture accepts their form of government. Islam today is a perfect example of this absorption. I say absorption because they don't assimilate into a culture, they change it. Islam has changed our sister country, Britain, to the point where the British will not even teach their children British history any longer because it might offend a Muslim. On April 27th of this year, 2010, an article from fsa.gov.uk, the British government website, announced quite proudly that the UK now is home to the first wholly Sharia-compliant retail bank in the West, Islamic Bank of Britain, which was authorized by the FSA. Might I submit to you that Islam is on track to do the same thing in America? In fact, it already has happened in America. A few years ago, in 2004, some really stupid people voted some Muslims into elective office in the American Congress for the first time. Keith Ellison of Minnesota and Barack Hussein Obama of Illinois. And now, in just a few years, we have a Muslim king, what we call a president. Hopefully, his tenure will not turn out to be for life, like the rulers of Esau, but that also is the Islamic MO, isn't it? There is another thing to note about Esau's government. Pay attention to the successions, starting in Genesis 36, verse 32. And Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, and the name of his city was Dinhaba. And Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his stead. And Jobab died, and Husham of the land of Tamani reigned in his stead. And Husham died, and Hadad, the son of Bedad, who smote Midian in the field of Moab, reigned in his stead, and the name of his city was Avith. And Hadad died, and Samla of Masrekah reigned in his stead. And Samla died, and Saul of Rehoboth by the river reigned in his stead. And Saul died, and Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, reigned in his stead. And Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, died. And Hadar reigned in his stead, and the name of his city was Pau. And his wife's name was Mehetabel, the daughter of Matred, the daughter of Mezahab. Bela, listed in verse 32, was the first Edomite ruler, or king, of Edom. An interesting note about Bela, the son of Beor, from the Jewish Encyclopedia, is that he is also called Balaam. You know, that guy who went to curse the children of Israel on behalf of Balak? Balaam was an Edomite. But did you notice that none of the rulers there were related to each other? This means Esau's form of government was an elective government, not a monarchy that is passed from father to son. We can reason that this was from elections because there were no wars mentioned regarding the transfer of power. So it was Esau, not the Greeks, who invented the elective form of government. Wikipedia defines democracy as a political form of government in which governing power is derived from the people either by direct referendum or by means of elected representatives of the people. Wait a minute! All our history books teach that democracy came from Greece. But our Bibles reveal something different and quite extraordinary. Elective government, also known as democracy, came from Esau. In the Greek form, only the males voted. But not all males voted, only aristocratic males were allowed to vote. This is the same kind of situation we see in the list of Edomite rulers. There is no mention that the people elected the rulers. Without the Bible making mention of any warfare regarding who would succeed each ruler, the only alternative is that the ruling elite of Edom participated in electing the successor. Thus, Greece adopted democracy from the Edomites. Also, what appears to be happening here is a wandering capital. Whoever got elected to be the king reigned from the city from which he came. In addition, there were local governments headed up by Edomite dukes, what we call today governors. These would have been Edomite aristocrats. Let's look at Genesis 36:40. These are the names of the dukes that came of Esau, according to their families, after their places, by their names. Duke Timnah, Duke Alva, Duke Jetheth, Duke Aholibamah, Duke Elah, Duke Pinnon, Duke Kenaz, Duke Taman, Duke Mibzar, Duke Magdiel, Duke Iram. These be the dukes of Edom, according to their habitations in the land of their possession. He is Esau, the father of the Edomites. Esau's descendants are called Edomites, and then later they're called Idumeans as well. The Horites' existence ends in verse 29. Why? Because once an Edomite gets into power, there is no getting it back. It's interesting that Esau's form of government actually became the model for other elective governments like the Greek, the Roman Empire, Great Britain, eventually, and the United States, along with many other westernized nations. I want to bring your attention to the fact also that elections are a part of the Roman Catholic life as well. The popes are elected for life in the same way as the rulers of Edom were elected for life. We've just looked at the biblical account of Esau. So now let's take a historical look at the Edomites. The Edomites were a source of difficulty during the wanderings of the children of Israel in the desert by refusing to let them pass through Edomite territory. The portion of land given to Judah was bordered by Edom. In Judges 5, Deborah sang praises to God for a particular victory. Lord, when you went out of Seir, when you marched out of the field of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens dropped. The clouds also dropped water. That's from verse 4. Saul went to war against the Edomites in 1 Samuel 14. But eventually, the Edomites were ruled by the Israelites. This occurred after David began to reign in Israel. 2 Samuel 8:14. And he put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom put he garrisons, and all they of Edom became David's servants. And the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. But later, the Edomites rose up against Israel again after David died during the time of Solomon, 1 Kings 11:14. And the Lord stirred up an adversary unto Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was of the king's seed in Edom. So Edom became a vassal of Israel, who raised up a thorn to be in Solomon's side. Even after the kingdom split into the house of Judah and the house of Israel, Edom was still a vassal of the house of Judah until the time of Jehoshaphat. This is important to remember as we go through this teaching, because Edom has remained with Judah to this day. 2 Kings 8:20. In his days, Edom revolted from under the hand of Judah and made a king over themselves. This was only one instance of revolt against Judah. There were other wars and skirmishes between the house of Judah and the Edomites, but by then, according to many historians, it was too late for either culture to maintain separation. The Edomites were very much Judahized, and Judah had taken on some of the Edomite customs. This also is a very important point in tracing Esau to modern times. Another extra-biblical source, the two books of Maccabees, describes a Jewish family who had ruled over Edom for about 100 years. According to the New Standard Jewish Encyclopedia, 1977, page 589, and Encyclopedia Judaica, 1971, volume 6, page 378, quote, Judah Maccabee's son, John Hyrcanus, conquered the whole of Edom and undertook the forced conversion of its inhabitants to Judaism. Unquote. Josephus, the Jewish historian, from Antiquities of the Jews, Book 13, Chapter 9, Section 1, informs us that, quote, Hyrcanus took Medaba, Samega, and the neighboring places, and besides these, Shechem and Gerizim, and the nation of the Cuthians, who dwelt at the temple which resembled the temple which was at Jerusalem. Hyrcanus took also Dora and Marissa, cities of Idumea, and subdued all the Idumeans, and they submitted to the use of circumcision and the rest of the Jewish ways of living. At that time, therefore, this befell them, that they were hereafter no other than Jews. Unquote. In an article on Edom, the Jewish Encyclopedia 1925 edition has this statement, quote, In 163 BC, Judas Maccabeus conquered the Edomite territory for a time. They, meaning the Edomites, were again subdued by John Hyrcanus, about 125 BC, by whom they were forced to observe Jewish rites and laws. They were then incorporated with the Jewish nation, and their country was called by the Greeks and Romans Idumea. With Antipater began the Idumean dynasty that ruled over Judea till its conquest by the Romans. From this time, the Idumeans ceased to be a separate people. Unquote. Again, we see how the Edomites get into government and just take it over. And it happens almost overnight. Within just 125 years, the Edomites went from captives of Israel to rulers of it. Get this. Muslims have been migrating to America since 1880. In 2010, that's 130 years. In 2004, that was 124 years. Another web author put it this way, quote, So 100 years before Christ, Judah was inhabited by Edomites and native Israelites, who were both followers of Talmudic Judaism, seeming to heal the breach between Jacob and Esau. But the Edomites proved to be a discordant element, and in 37 BC, Herod the Great, an Idumean or Edomite whose wife Mariamne was a Maccabean, became at the age of 36 undisputed ruler of Judea. The Pharisees gained ascendancy over the Sadducees, and there were so many Edomites in the population at the time of Christ that the land was called Idumea. That's from Mark 3, verse 8. The Edomites participated in the defense of Jerusalem against the Romans during Titus' siege of AD 66 to AD 70. According to the Jewish Encyclopedia, 1904, volume 5, page 41, quote, immediately before the siege of Jerusalem, 20,000 Idumeans appeared before Jerusalem to fight in behalf of the zealots who were besieged in the temple, unquote. More than 1 million inhabitants of Judea died, and 97,000 were taken captive. An unknown number had fled either before or during the siege. What is fascinating is that this is the last mention in history of the Edomites as a people. Yet, Bible prophecy indicates that Edom would be an enemy of Israel in the latter days. And we find that their only connection to a present-day people and religion is with the so-called Jews and Rabbinism or Judaism, unquote. I will refute the last statement made by this author later on. We will see that the Edomites have found other places to overrun as well. From Encyclopedia Biblica, quote, "How thoroughly the Edomites were at length transformed into Jews is shown, for example, by the fact that among the very few names which are mentioned as having been borne by Edomites in those times, that of Jacob, the brother and rival of Esau, occurs twice. We find, moreover, the characteristic Jewish names Simon, John, and Phinehas." Unquote. Historically, the term Jew became not a name or title for the tribe of Judah, but an epithet for everyone who lived in Judea. And Judea had people from every nation because of Solomon's excessive marriages. If you will recall, Balaam, Bela, the first Edomite king, announced to the world the way to destroy Israel was to intermarry with them. Edom and the surrounding nations took that seriously and have interbred with Jacob's descendants. Many sources believe that Rome was itself overrun by Edomites who had become mercenaries in Rome's wars. As they did with the Horites, they quietly rose to power, a description that also fits with the earlier Hyksos who left Egypt at around the same time as the children of Israel. The Hyksos are believed to be descendants of Esau as well. I can't go into this a whole lot. There are other teachers that have material regarding this, but the M.O. of the Hyksos who lived among Jacob's children in Egypt is the same as that of today's Muslims and of the earlier Edomites. They have a plan. They move in quietly. That's what the Hyksos did. They get along. They buy a business and start networking. Then they get on the city council. Everyone likes them and thinks they're gentle people, so they elect or appoint them to an important post. More and more of them rise through the ranks of politics and government until they begin to make demands. After the demands come the skirmishes that lead to outright war. We know this is the Muslim M.O., but it really is the Edomite M.O. The Edomites have taught it to the Muslims. A short history of Rome is necessary in order to continue piecing this together. The poet Virgil, who lived from 70 BC to 21 BC, traced the founding of Rome to King Latinus of Troy. Rome's earliest history is shrouded in mystery. It was said to have been founded by the god Romulus in 753 BC. This is about 500 years after Latinus of Troy is said to have conquered it. Historians have no plausible explanation for this discrepancy. The point is this, however. Rome was a city at least 500 years before Yeshua was born, and perhaps for another 700 years prior to that. Rome is a very old city. Now, going with the Latinist point of view, we can make sense of some of the traits of Rome. For instance, just the fact of the word Latin, which was the language of Rome for a very long time. The Latins were a simple agrarian people who were hounded and infiltrated by the Greeks from the beginning. Sounds almost like an Edomite trait, doesn't it? This is important because Greek culture had the heaviest influence on the Latins, the Romans, of all the surrounding peoples. Since it was Greece that conquered Troy, Latinus' home country, it then makes sense that the Greeks followed Latinus to Rome and infiltrated the culture with Greek gods and the like, which is why Roman and Greek cultures are so much alike. The hybridized Romans then, seeking a national identity, later managed to give their gods different names than the names of the Greek gods, but the attributes of the Roman and Greek gods and cultures remained. Both the Greeks and the Romans were conquering peoples, and when the armies needed more recruits, they hired them from outside their culture. Enter the Edomites, the descendants of Esau. Esau, who it was said would live by the sword. The ranks of the Roman Empire became filled with enlisted Edomites. Now, these particular Edomites were not from the hybridized house of Judah. They were the original Edomites from the area of Mount Seir. Later, these Edomites would be an invading army against the house of Judah Edomites who defended Jerusalem. But Edomites also got to the Roman Empire via another route. Edom came under the control of the Arabs in the 5th century BC. The mercenary Edomites among the Assyrians that moved north to Rome enlisted in large numbers into the Roman army, and often, if they did not volunteer for military service, they were conscripted or forced. One way or another, historians and rabbis alike agree that Rome and Edom became one and the same entity. First, the mingling of the darker Semitic Edomites with the people of Italy account for the two distinct populations. Darker Semitic-like people in the south and fair-skinned people in the north. Wikipedia says, quote, Herod the First or Herod the Great was an Edomite Jewish Roman client king of the Roman provinces of Judea, Galilee, and Samaria, present-day Israel, unquote. There are some who say the Palestinians are descended from the Philistines. This is partially true. If we listen to the Palestinians on this, some claim direct descendancy from Esau, some from the Philistines, some from the Canaanites, and some from Ishmael. However, it was the Edomite Romans who named Israel as Palestine. Clark's commentary says that Constantine and the emperors after him were all Edomites. This comes from Adam Clark's commentary on Isaiah 34, quote, this chapter points out the future destruction of Rome, which is here called Bozra. For Bozra was a great city of the Edomites. Now, the major part of the Romans are Edomites who profess the law of Jesus. The Emperor Caesar, Constantine, was an Edomite, and so were all the emperors after him. Unquote. Remember, I told you the Jews considered Rome an Edomite city? They nicknamed it Bozra in honor of the capital of Edom and the Edomites who had infiltrated the highest levels of the Edomite Roman Empire. Now, the biblical Bozra is not Rome, as per Clark's commentary, but a city in Lower Jordan where the future sheepfolds will be when Yeshua returns. Let's turn to Micah chapter 2, verse 12. I will surely assemble, O Jacob, all of you. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together as the sheep of Bozra, as the flock in the midst of their fold. They shall make great noise by reason of the multitude of men. Bozra is mentioned in 9 verses in the Tanakh. It was an established city before Rome was ever thought of. It will be Bozra, not Rome, where the Lord will return. Why? Because Bozra is in the land that he swore to Abraham. Rome is not. However, it is good for us to understand the connection between Bozra of ancient Edom, which is now Lower Jordan, and its nicknamed counterpart, Rome. According to Yair Davidi, whose ministry is to trace the Semitic people's wanderings, says, quote, "In addition, we find elements of Edom in Italy, Spain, Gaul, Britain, and elsewhere in Europe. In most cases, the Edomites settled as a minority, though they often may have reached to leadership positions. Descendants of Esau settled in Babylon and in some of the Phoenician cities such as Tyre. Both Babylon and Tyre in Scripture are associated with Edom." Unquote. Babylon and Tyre. Edom. What about Mystery Babylon? Could it be that the New World Order system that represents Mystery Babylon is Edomite as well? That question will be answered in another section. Have you noticed the mercenary trait of the Edomites? Let's compare that to the westernized nations where the House of Israel is right now. In particular, let's look at the American military. Like the Romans, the U.S. military uses a volunteer enlisted military exactly like the Roman Edomite Empire. America's armies have always been volunteer enlisted armies throughout its history, except for a short period when the draft was used from 1940 to 1973. However, volunteers were still welcome in the military during that time. Furthermore, the U.S. government has not only used enlisted men like ancient Edomite Rome, but America is known to have used mercenaries as well throughout its history. This trait is what allowed the Edomites to rise to power in the young, unformed Italian Empire, even before it became an empire. Again, the historians call the Roman Empire the Empire of the Edomites. Is it possible that Esau's dominion was already fulfilled when the Edomite Roman army overran Jerusalem in 70 AD? No. Why? Because the house of Israel was already scattered into northern Europe and elsewhere. Not all of the house of Israel was present in Judea at that time. The dominion over Jacob is over all of Jacob, not part of him. Esau would have to wait until a time when he could have dominion over the whole house of Jacob. In other words, it would have to be a global dominion, because that's where Jacob has gone, globally. Well, what about the possibility that Esau gained dominion with the Edomite Roman Catholic Church during its Inquisition in Europe? No. Why? Because some of the house of Israel eventually escaped to the New World, America, before the church gained dominion in every place where Jacob had gone. The Inquisition ended in dishonor of the Catholic Church, was not an end-time event, did not result in the protection of the bride in Bozra or other wilderness, and it did not lead to the Messiah's millennial reign. However, that is not to say that Esau did not gain partial dominion in certain areas of the globe at certain times in history. He did. He just couldn't seem to gain dominion all at once over the whole house of Jacob. But now, the time has come when Esau has gotten the dominion over the whole house of Jacob. It is necessary for this dominion to occur before God destroys the house of Esau. And the house of Esau's destruction doesn't happen until the end. In the next section, I will explain this dominion further and show you the sign of its occurrence. For now, I leave you with this, John 14, verse 27. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, give I unto you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. Shalom.